symbol of excellence in sports entertainment.
Hello and welcome to ARN. This is Paul Bromwell, and today I'm joined by the Hall of Famer, the founder of the Four Horsemen, the creator of the Spine Buster, the 1A Tag Team Wrestling, our TV champion, my tag team partner. He's Arn Anderson. Arn, how are you this week, my friend?
Whew, I'm cold. That jacket that's over your right shoulder, I just took off the matching one. Man, it's cold here. Is it cold there?
It is cold, man. It's like, I think the high today was 41 with temperatures continuing to drop. We're probably going to get some snow up this way.
Probably get down in the 20s, right?
Oh, man, it's no fun. It doesn't get that cold in Charlotte, does it?
Very rarely. Yeah. Very rarely. But it gets, you know, it's a crazy thing because it's so humid here. When it gets cold, it's a damp cold. So it chills you a little more. Yeah.
But you guys, do you see much snow at all? Is it a rarity when you see? Okay.
Zero.
See, that's perfect. You really live in a nice area. That's weather-wise.
That's why I'm still here, bud.
I know. Just got to get a better football team.
You had to go there. You had to go there.
By the time this drops, we'll know who have made the NFL playoffs. We'll know who have won the college championship. You and I, obviously, we do this a little earlier, so we don't know. But Carolina, man, not having that first-round pick next year kind of stinks. But
yeah, I mean, I don't want to just sit here and denigrate the guys. It's pretty clear. I mean, I'm not talented enough to play pro football, so I won't just stomp them every chance I get. We're just such huge fans. It breaks our heart.
I understand.
To see them not do well.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you definitely want to cheer a winner, at least someone who's going to, you think, give a shot every year, making the playoffs or something, but I totally hear you, but you know what? We'll see what happens. You stay faithful to them. Their owner, by the way, did you see where he like threw a drink out of the skybox at somebody? Did you see that, David Tepper?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's not acceptable when you own an NFL team, is it?
No, I don't know what he's losing his mind, and he flipped a drink outside of his box. And then at the end of the clip, I saw one of the fans starting to climb up, and I'm like, what is going on down there?
Oh, something, man. That's going to end up in a lawsuit, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's ugly. Well, let me tell you, let's talk about something that's not ugly and something that I do enjoy and I'm excited about. And that was last week's episode, Arn. Jerry Briscoe, we talked a little bit at Glory Days and some of the old territory wrestling times, talked about Ole. But really what was the highlight of last week's episode was that surprise announcement that you're in the National Wrestling Hall of Fame, the class of 2024. Quite the honor. And as I said at the end of last week's show, I can't think of, you know, anyone more deserving than you are to be inducted into the Hall of Fame. Congratulations once again, my friend.
Well, thanks. And let me just say, you set me up because you got a hold of me a couple days, like a day before you sent me a message. We're going to have Jerry Briscoe on the show. You cool with that? And I went, well, of course. But I thought, well, I mean, there was really no setup for this. This was like,
I had to play it as smooth as possible. I waited for you to say, hey, when are we taping?
And you did. Right. And I'm great with it. It just was one of those things that's, I mean, he fits on any show he's on, you know, Jerry, he's legendary, you know, he's got stories up the yazoo, but it just kind of came out of nowhere. But I just thought, well, okay, great. We don't have guests very often. That'll make it really special.
And that's why I thought, man, he may just poke a little bit more to be like, oh, something happened, or that's, you know, not that it's not, obviously I knew you would think it's great, but I thought you might poke. You didn't poke at all. And so I was like, cool, because now I'm really going to be vague. I just said, we'll talk about old territory time and catch up. And you're like, all right, great. And I'm like, man, that was easier than I thought. I can't wait for this.
I'm easy, right?
Yeah.
Supposed to be easy.
Piece of cake, man. And when he started talking, did you know it as soon as he started talking, or was it at what point were you like, something's happening here?
Not really. Okay. I just thought it was going to be just a bullshit session, which I'm good at, which I can handle that. That's easy. Yeah.
Once he started talking about the award, though, and then that video was a home run.
Got a little emotional while that was playing because it just.
That was the goal.
I'm not used to being honored like that in that capacity. So for everybody, you too, buddy, especially you, thank you very, very much for everybody that had a part in it. And I will treasure this for the rest of me days.
Yep. And Aaron and Brock can celebrate with you. And, you know, by now you've all gotten to see the video together. And so just really excited about that. And so well done. And again, shout out to Chris McDonald for all your hard work and effort with that. But man, before we jump in, we're going to finally get back to our regularly scheduled programming. As I said last week, we're going to pick things up with March 94. Before we do that, Arn, you mentioned the jacket. The horseman jacket. We got to talk about boxofgimmicks.com. That's the easiest way for everybody to find your merch, whether it's the horseman store or the Arn store. They got it all, and everything is back in stock. All the best sellers, the horseman shirt, the enforcing shirt that created by JD Hoop, the shirt, the sweatshirt that I'm wearing now, and the t-shirt design. Miss Amy was just telling me she was saying, man, Paul, I wish after I saw your hoodie that I would have grabbed the hoodie. I said, guess what, Amy? You can still grab the hoodie.
It's not too late. The white.
You got the t-shirt.
I really like the white and black one.
Yeah. JD had. Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. You know, that's sharp. That looks good too.
Yeah. I like the Carolina blue. I'm a fan of Carolina blue colors. And, but yeah, flying off the shelves, he's done a great job. And then the centerpiece of the collection has to be the horseman hats and the jackets. I'm rocking mine every episode, the hat. We got it right here behind my shoulder. And then, man, that classic bomber style jacket with the embroidery, top notch, Arn. You've not seen anything like it in your day, except the original. And yes. So it's available for everyone right now in your store.
And hey, there's a lot of winter left, guys, depending on where you live. So not too late. Get your orders in.
What I love is they're true to size. The design is on point. And that was really the thing for us when we were trying to find a vendor, is someone that made them true to size. And because that was a problem the first go around. Not anymore. No, these will fit well. And they're can't miss for any Arn fan or collector. So check them out.
You can take it off, wad it up. Put it in a bag, pull it out. Perfect.
Check it out. Go to arnlinks.com, and then you can buy the jacket, wad it up, put it in the bag yourself, carry it wherever you want to go, and put it on. And we appreciate all your support. Arnlinks.com or boxofgimmicks.com will get you there too. And we mentioned last week at the end of the episode about your book, Arn Anderson, My Life as Wrestling's Enforcer, and that Dirk Manning had shared an update. The project had some delays, some hiccups, but man, it is on track now. We appreciate everybody's patience and understanding. But buddy, this is a heck of a way to kick off the new year with your graphic novel. I saw a picture that was sent out and it was going to be sent out, and it was the Trans Am picture. You know what I'm talking about. There was
DiBiase's.
Yeah, DiBiase's Trans Am. And I'm like, they got a picture of the Trans Am in there. That popped me because that's one of my favorite muscle cars. I can't wait to see what the rest of it looks like.
Oh, yeah, man. I mean, it's the Smokey and the Bandit black TA.
That's what DiBiase had.
What do you think? He just had me drive so he could sleep.
Nice.
Little did he know, I was sitting there cheesing like you wouldn't believe, going down the highway, rolled the window down so everybody saw me.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
hell yes.
Did he had the T-tops and everything? Yeah, the tops out?
Everything. No, not the tops out, but yes, okay. He had them. I mean, it was the black Smokey and the Bandit Trans Am.
Oh, so cool. So cool. It's in there, illustrated, looks great. And so much other, so many great stories of Arn and his career. Can't wait for you all to check it out. But, buddy, let's get into it. Let's get into March 1994. It's been 3 weeks since we last recorded. So as a reminder, I thought I'd bring you up to speed on what we talked about last. We watched that crazy ending to the Flair and Vader feud over the world title. Remember that Thunder Cage match?
Yes.
Okay. And we saw Rick Rude and Sting escalate their issue following that match. You wrestled His Lordship, Steven Regal, that night in a 30-minute match for the television title. And this is where I want to make a little bit of an announcement, Arn. I was just telling you about this. But some of you are going to be happy and some of you are not going to be thrilled. We really don't have a choice. We have to make a format change here on the show where we are not allowed, I'll just say this, to use video clips on the show anymore. And so we'll just leave it at that. It is what it is. But Arn, the good news is we still have a lot of stories to tell regarding your career, and we're going to do our best. We're going to start referencing some televised wrestling and the pay-per-view events, but we're going to lean into some other sources that were available for wrestling at this time, including magazines, newsletters, because that's what we have. We have that at our disposal with not having those clips. Now, listen, Arn, I've heard feedback over from people over the time of the show. They were like, oh, you play too many clips. So we've just made some of the audience happy that don't have to sit there and listen through the clips. And then others who like to watch it on YouTube, maybe not as thrilled. But we're going to deal with the hand that was dealt us and make the best of it. And we're still going to enjoy the show and have a good time with it. How's that sound?
We're not going to fight City Hall because that's not the intention of this podcast. We will make it as entertaining as we can for you.
There you go. So we'll do that. And we're going to get started with this month's show, March 1994. And I'd like to begin our coverage this week, Arn, by sharing some of what was written in the February 28th, 1994 edition of The Observer about the Super Brawl pay-per-view event itself. According to the Observer poll, Arn, the best match of the night was the six-man Thunder Cage match that featured Rick Rude, Stone Cold at the time. He was stunning Steve Austin and Paul Orndorff. They took on Dustin Rhodes, Brian Pillman, and the franchise Sting. But interestingly, what I wanted to talk to you about, your match with Regal received votes for being the best and the worst match on the card. And this is what Dave Meltzer had to say about it. Steve Regal pinned Arn Anderson in 27 minutes and 32 seconds to keep the TV title. When Anderson went for a sunset flip, Regal grabbed Sir William's umbrella and sat on Arn for the pin. Way too long. They shaved time, so it was announced as being 6 seconds before the 30-minute time limit expired. This pin, and before the time limit expired, that this pin actually took place. Dave Meltzer gave it a half star rating. Before we get into his assessment, Arn, so many wrestling fans make a big deal about what Meltzer writes, whether they agree with it or not. He is, however, a historian for the wrestling business, and that he does report the events that take place inside pro wrestling. And he's done it, Arn, since the 80s. And his write-up is simply that. It's his opinion. So I want to ask you, I'm certain we have not spoke about this in all the time that me and you have been together doing the show. What do you think about wrestling journalism in general? Is there a place for reporters, do you think, in wrestling?
They all have a right to their opinion. Everybody should have an opinion if you're watching it. And if it's a negative thing for me, then I'm just not their cup of tea. Regal and I had a match that would appeal to amateurs, guys that can see what's going on and understand it. It would have been different from every match on the card. The pacing would have been a lot slower than what a lot of people like. I've often said can't do a whole lot, so I don't do a lot. But what I do, I try to do well. That would have been what would have been going on, as well as, you know, William Regal is I highly regard as being a hugely talented wrestler. He could have a match with himself in an empty building. And it would be, for those of us that appreciate what he does, it would still be entertaining. So that's cool. If Meltzer thought it was, I'm sure he thought it was not so high impact, not a lot of stuff out on the floor, not a lot of excitement. It would not appeal to him. And he's always had the right to his opinion. It's not going to affect what I do or how I see the business.
I want to ask, did you ever have an issue with the dirt sheets at all in your career that you can recall or that you can remember just thinking back to your time in wrestling?
I very seldom ever saw one.
Okay.
I mean, like I said, I had I had my routine. I had the storyline from television. I knew what I had to do, and it wasn't going to change anything if I'm getting a high, hard one from some of the, writers.
The other nice thing, too, Arn, when you wrestled, and this is a big deal, especially nowadays, you didn't have to worry about social media.
Nope. And again, all those people, you don't have your own opinion. You know, this is America. Whatever you think, you can say. Just have some class about yourself and have some honesty in what you're talking about. Don't just be somebody that goes in and just hates everything and shits all over everything. Because my question is, why do you watch? Why are you watching?
Is it something too, like, and this is not necessarily your wrestling days, but maybe more as a coach and just working with younger talent in the last several years that you have, is it something too, where you've kind of had to help folks with just developing a thick skin or kind of help, because it does bother people. And as much as they say they won't, trust me, I know. Even doing a show with you, there's people that are going to have opinions about everybody's work and how you work, and they're vocal. And like you said, unfortunately, people are going to tell you the good, the bad, and the ugly. And it is what it is. Do you feel like that's a major difference in today's wrestling, that they're up against a lot more when it comes to public opinion? And do you feel like it's something that you've had to talk to wrestlers about?
Well, I hope it would start at the very, very top of the company I work for. If they don't make a big deal out of it and don't let it be the end all be all, because it trickles down. If they're not worried about it, it makes it a lot easier on the talent to go out and do what they do well. But if they feel like the boss and the owners and the bosses and managers and all those guys, if they're paying close attention to it, for a young guy trying to learn the business, that would be a tough sell.
Yeah.
How do you know what's right? And instead of doing what the social media people are calling for, sometimes it's right on. Boom. They got it. They nailed it. Sometimes it's not. We got to be smart enough as the ones that manage the business to take it with a grain of salt.
So your message to talent nowadays is, listen, as long as your boss is happy, your coaches are happy, you focus on that and do your job.
And people are screaming and screaming loud.
Yeah,
that's our audience screaming and screaming loud. You can never really go wrong.
Getting back to the match that you had with Regal here. At this point too, Arn, we know that Regal worked a style that at that time was not popularized in the same way that it is now. Today, that style, we respect it. We go back and look at it and are like, man, he could wrestle a broomstick for 25 minutes and we're all in, because I think there's a bigger appreciation for what he did in the ring now than maybe it was new. And I don't think the fans were, or even maybe Meltzer, appreciated that style of wrestling back then.
Well, yeah, because he was the only one doing it. Yeah. And it was, something that you see and went, God, I never saw that before, but guys like me appreciated that because I knew what it took to get there. Maybe the audience was more confused than they were anything else.
Yeah, there was no holes in his work. He just criticized it that it was too long. So, maybe the style at that point just wasn't for him. And also, again, we're acclimating to it as an American wrestling audience. Mm-hmm. So there you go. Well, listen, while Super Brawl was a major event, as far as the wrestling industry was concerned, it was not the most important thing happening. And you and I kind of teased this last week, and I was talking about what we're going to talk about this week. It's Hulk Hogan. He was last seen in WWF in June of 93, Arn, losing the title to Yokozuna at the King of the Ring pay-per-view. And the rumors are swirling now about him coming to WCW rather than returning to the WWF. Arn, Hulkamania officially begins January 23rd, 1984. As this episode drops on the 13th, we are about a week and a half away from the 40-year anniversary of when Hulk Hogan defeated the Iron Sheik. Isn't that crazy to think about? 40 years ago, 40-year anniversary.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's got to make you feel old.
It does, because I was, well, how old was I? I was six years old, five going on six, what, January 84? Yeah. I mean, come on now, 40 years ago.
Well, it's mind-boggling if you, okay, look at, he beat the Sheik in record time, right?
Yeah, Madison Square Garden, wins the belt, Hulkamania is born. The next 9 years, it's Hogan and WWF.
Think of how the business became Hulk Hogan, lunchboxes, ice creams,
cartoons.
Merchandise, cartoons, you name it, how it morphed to where it is now and everything in between.
That was real Vince. I mean, and honestly, it was Vince. 1984 is such a big year in wrestling. I was just telling Kevin Sullivan the other day, I watched a third party documentary done by Cultaholic. It's fantastic. And it's going through the early years all the way through. They did a whole series. It's amazing. But 1984, I sat there and watched, and I thought, what a transitional year, Vince buying the company, and then how he took on the territories and started growing his business. And it came with Hulk, and then Talon he brought in, and Okerlund, and Piper, and really grew. And then it just went from there. Everything just continued to explode. And now here we sit. You have AEW, WWE, two nights of WrestleMania, pay-per-views galore, international. It's exploded. Isn't that something? Just the growth. And it really all started back in that early 80s time frame when territories, when Vince had the vision, and it changed everything.
You know, and I was sitting there for that year, 1984. I was living in Pensacola on the beach. I had met Aaron. I was having the time of my life. But we would watch that show and we would go, holy smokes, what a spectacle. And when it really became something concrete that I could put, I mean, cause we're watching it just like wrestling fans, you know, we were living down in Pensacola. We would watch the show and, it's like, okay, you know, I see all the, you know, how everything is morphing and how it's getting more exciting and it's bigger and all the quality, I guess you would just call it, you know, the video packages, just everything.
Production
yeah. was at a different level. I mean, it was like when it became real for me is when the Tonga Kid, who was at that time, was down in wrestling. Jerry Stubbs and myself with Scott Armstrong and Tommy or Johnny Rich. They were the Rat Pack, and we were wrestling those guys, and he got the call to go to New York. And I've told the story on this show and probably every other show. After he got the call and he went to New York, a couple weeks went by, and it was either offer or seeker, no disrespect, but came down to the building and in Pensacola, came in the locker room, asked if he could see me in the bathroom. That you knew what that meant, right? So I was fixing to get killed pretty much.
Sheesh.
I mean, in those days, if somebody said, I need to see you in the bathroom, you better go in there swinging because
you're getting your ass kicked.
Yeah. Somebody has planned this and here we go. And he called me and he said, the kid called from New York. He's been up there a couple of weeks. I just wanted to thank you. He said, you're one of the guys, you know, responsible for helping him so much. He made $3,000 last week. His weekly check at that time and his position with Continental would have been worth about $500.
Oh, man.
That's when it became real to me. It was a concrete number. And he's only been up there a couple of weeks. It's not like, I mean, he's first match. That's first match money those days, you know, opening match money.
That's game-changing money.
That's when it became real to me. I went, holy shit, maybe we better look at this in a, you know, a different way. What does it take to get up there and all this?
It was a boom period. They talk about Dick Ebersol coming in and helping change the production, Saturday night's main event, all this, all the things that started to happen so quickly. And I talk about that because you know, his run comes to an end largely at WrestleMania 8 when he went back to Hollywood. Vince turned to Flair, Bret Hart, Yokozuna to carry the title. And let's not forget at this time, the federal government, by the way, charges McMahon with the distribution of steroids. So he's fighting for his company as well as freedom. Bruce and Conrad covered this on episode 7 of Something to Wrestle With, but I lay all this out so we could break some of this down, because how big of a deal is it that Hulk Hogan is expressing interest in coming to WCW here in spring of 1994?
Well, it's huge. It's
huge. Yeah.
Because, I mean, there was, when you've built a company that has exploded like WWF, and that's your center point, in your mind, you think there is no way Vince will ever let him leave. It just, he will make it right, whatever that number is.
He'll figure it out, right.
Yeah, they will work this out, because I don't think Hulk will want to leave, because that setting only exists with WWF.
Do you remember when you personally heard that Hogan was interested in coming to the company? Do you remember anything about this time period?
Not sure about it.
You weren't buying it.
I just kept thinking he was using that as, you know, because
a bargaining chip.
Bargaining chip it would be, yes.
Yeah.
You know, because, well, Ted Turner had the money. It wasn't like he did, you know, it couldn't happen. I was looking at more on the side that Vince would work it out with Hogan. It was just, they're using it as a bargaining chip.
Well, we're going to discuss in some upcoming episodes, but Flair was instrumental in bringing Hulk to the company. Do you remember any conversation with Rick concerning him trying to help Bischoff sign Hogan?
Well, yeah, because Rick knew he would work with Hogan. It was going to help the company. It was going to help Rick. Rick could see the, you know, he could see the benefit in working with Hogan as a flagship for WCW and what that would do for business. Yeah. Yeah, we talked about that. I was still a little skeptical, but
yeah, because you got to think, too, as a wrestler, you got to go. Where do we fall in the pecking order? But, Arn, you got to be thinking, man, bigger houses, bigger pay-per-view buys. But you're under a set contract, so do you necessarily think about it that way? Or what are your thoughts business-wise?
I was thinking more, they're not going to go around and start giving guys raises or anything like that. Mm. What I thought about was it's going to strengthen the company going forward for being in business for years to come, long term.
I got you.
It's job security.
Yeah. Well, Meltzer followed the situation and reported on it as early as February 28th, 1994, and he wrote an extensive blurb that I want your thoughts on. Here's the first part. While to the best of our knowledge, no contracts have been officially signed, and those close to Hogan continue to insist no deal has been made, WCW officials are clearly under the impression that not only will a Flair Hogan match headline the Great American Bash in July, but they'll also headline numerous house shows during the summer, and that plans were to be made this week for the run, with the belief that Hogan would start appearing on television to kick things off in May. Okay, so Hulk does not actually sign with the company until June, but part of this that is so interesting is that WCW wanted the Flair Hogan main event from the beginning. Arn, do you think that's the right call, working for that dream match, you know, that, by the way, never took place except on a house show in WWF from 91 to 92? Why do you think that makes sense? Or maybe start them off with a Vader, or, you know, maybe warm up to it. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, hindsight being 2020, and we always go there, you know, Monday morning quarterback, don't you want something to build to?
Right.
Wouldn't you think?
I mean, because everybody wants to see it, but you got to, like, let's tell a story to get there.
If you walk in the door and you're already in each other's grill, you've already satisfied me a little bit, partially.
Yeah. So you, looking back now, you would say, hey, let's start them with some other guys for the first few shows just to get it going.
I'd have one show where he walks out. You know, number one, Hogan's contract must have ran out with Vince before they got a hold of it. Don't you think something?
He was done. He was done. He had already taken a break. He was doing, I think, Trouble. What is it? Trouble in Paradise, or what was the show in Paradise? I can't even remember.
The Beach Show. Yeah,
the Beach Show. We'll call it the Beach Show.
Right.
So he was already doing stuff like that, and I think that's where Eric really connected with him when he was down doing the shows in Florida. And Thunder in Paradise, that's what it is. I knew it would come to my brain. But, yeah, and so that's where they really started talking. I want to read this to you. The New York Daily News and its gossip page on February 18th reported Hogan would receive something like $1 million per pay-per-view event. Okay, as well as percentage points on each event's gross receipts. It's also reported the first Hogan Flair match is taking place on WCW's huge summer pay-per-view event, which seemingly would mean the Bash show in early July. The $1 million plus points per show figure can be dismissed as hyperbole, since most WCW pay-per-view events only gross the company in the $1 to $1.2 million range to begin with. For Hogan to be worth that kind of figure, he'd have to double the current number of buys. Or in other words, on his first show in, to be worth a figure like that, the WCW pay-per-view show would have to do the same number or more buys than the past two WWF shows would have done. The Flair-Hogan matches will do far more business than any other match WCW could put on, either on pay-per-view or at the arenas. But as someone who's worked with Hogan during the height of the golden era, did you think that he had the potential to have that kind of financial impact from the company that Meltzer's talking about here?
I'm not sure I got that in depth into my thinking.
Yeah.
I was more thinking that if they had to take a little bit of a haircut because he was making so much, that they would just eat that for now with the idea that it's going to change the company totally, the perception of the, and they would make it up down the road. That's the only thing that makes any sense, isn't it?
Yeah, I agree. It makes sense to me.
Here's what you want. Okay. But we're going to have to double the house or the buys from last time. You know, if that's the case, I don't know that the expectations could be that could happen, even into having a conversation about it.
Yeah.
You're going to walk in and double our business right away.
Right.
Well, then if that's the case, day one, if he doubles the business, damn, he's worth whatever you want.
Yeah.
Whatever he wants.
And $1 million, if that's the case. One more final observation from Meltzer, and then we'll move on to our next topic. He wrote, to sustain that business over a period of time would require both men to put the other over in a fairly clean method at different points in the national exposure matches. Well, there's no doubt, judging from past history, that Flair would cleanly put Hogan over at some point. The reverse can't be said with anything resembling certainty. And it's Hogan putting Flair over cleanly at the beginning, which is the key to the feud's longevity, because it's the one result people don't expect and will make them interested in future matches. Again, Dave Meltzer's point here. And it's pretty cut and dry with him. They're claiming that in order for them to do business with each other and make this work, he would have to do so, and it had to be even with Flair, the wins and losses. And you might not recall this specifically, but do you remember Hulk being difficult to work with in any of your dealings with him?
Way far above my
you weren't necessarily dealing with that stuff. Yeah.
No, that's what we knew, that he had creative liberty.
Yeah, and you know, he did have creative control. Yeah.
You know what creative control means?
He does what he wants.
If I don't like it, we don't do it.
Right.
Self-explanatory.
Would you have ever wanted to have creative control?
Oh, hell yes.
Arn would have been the 16-time television champion, baby.
37-time television champion.
There you go. Your fans have questions concerning Hogan and his potential impending arrival to WCW. Brendan Foley is first up. He says, hi, Arn, and thank you for a great podcast. This time period is right before Hulk Hogan debuts with WCW. Where did you imagine Arn Anderson would be a year later, in March of 95, in a WCW led by Hulk Hogan? Thanks again, and to Paul as well. Thank you, Brendan. So if you would have heard the news, hey, Hogan's coming, where of you would have seen things a year from then? And what would you think WCW would look like? And where would you be at in that picture?
God, good question.
Yeah.
Good question. I never thought that I would not be with the company. I felt like I had proven my worth as far as producing every time I was put in a situation. So it wasn't like I had shit the bed at some point and I'm going, oh gosh, hope that doesn't affect me going forward. I knew that Hogan would be smart enough to have some guys because he was going to bring in his crew of guys, Beefcake, Nasty Boys, you know, all of his crew. He had to have some guys there to make them mean something as well. I know that was in his thought process. It had to.
Oh, sure. And which he did. You would eventually see Beefcake and some of those guys come up with him. Brian Harems is up next. Do you feel that WCW was in a lull at this point, just waiting for Hulk Hogan to come in?
I don't know if they were waiting for Hogan to come in, but they were waiting for some changes. Because by then you had seen a lot of Sting and a lot of the guys, you know, that were there had been there for several years. You had seen them quite a bit. So it probably needed a
kick change. In the pants.
Yeah.
And you knew Eric too wanted to take it up a notch and go at it with WWF at this point, right?
Very aggressive. Yeah.
Yeah. So it kind of made sense for him to start getting aggressive with talent because then it was Hogan. Then who comes in? Macho Man. Then it starts, right?
Yep. And these guys were huge stars, as big a stars as there had been to that point, you know, up to date. Those guys were the biggest stars in the history of the business.
Yeah. And when you talk about a national or even a global level, Hogan and Savage, I mean, come on. Outside of Flair and a few other guys, they dominated the late 80s, Ultimate Warrior, Hogan, Flair. So he was ready to make that splash. We're going to move on from the issue with Hogan because you worked some matches of note in March of 1994 with some different opponents. And one that stood out when we put the research together was Diamond Dallas Page, Arn. We've not spoken about DDP much at this point, but he would not start wrestling until he's 35 years old. And he had an amazing career. He also had been a manager. He's been a color commentator at this point before he even turned out to be a wrestler. So we're going to talk a lot about DDP as we work our way through Nitro years in the upcoming shows. But I got a few questions for you here first. When did you and Paige originally meet? And what was your first impression of DDP?
Well, he was a manager to begin with.
That's right.
Right. Yeah. And
Diamond Stud. Remember Scott Hall?
Yeah, he had some good talent to manage, for sure. Diamond Stud was, you know, the one thing that we lacked in is, it's like when Vince got a hold of Scott Hall, he immediately turned him into a must-see character. We as WCW as a company didn't have the know-how yet to build stars characters. You know, and that was really the big difference. Vince could build characters, and he made him must-see. That was the one advantage that he really had. And, you know, Paige, you got to look at certain things. Paige was, you know, he wore cowboy boots, you know, out there, and he was already probably 6'3", 6'4", made him 6'6". You got to be careful that he wasn't bigger than the guy he was managing.
True.
You know, but he had that smarmy manager thing that, you know, Diamond Dallas Page, he was a strip club guy. That was the character managing the strip joints. So it was, that was the first impression, not knowing that he would become a wrestler after that.
And it's something to say a guy at 35 just decides, hey, I want to learn and be a worker. I mean, he committed to it and I mean, he hit it big.
Well, he made it work. You know, he hung in there. He worked hard. He had some good guys to work with who were willing to, you know, shine him up. And that's what you have. That's what you do in our business. You go out, and if that's the guy you're going to go with, I'll make him look like a trillion bucks.
Did you like him as a worker, and what'd you think of him as a promo guy?
Got along with him fine. You know, he was just different. He had his own style. You know, it was not something that I would say or do, but didn't matter. It wasn't about me. It was about him.
He had his own charisma, a different type of style of charisma, for sure.
Yes, he did.
Yeah, Adam Krasnoff has a question about DDP. He wrote, Eric Bischoff once said that DDP during his this time came to the ring with too many gimmicks. Would you agree? What are your thoughts on DDP and his character here in 1994?
Probably could lose the cigar.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know how that fit on an entrance, but, and I don't know, whatever else, you know, he had on the sunglasses and the wild outfit and the whole shooting match, right?
He was loud, man. He was loud.
Yeah, it was over the top, but that's who he was.
I want to ask you a follow-up question because you've been both wrestler and agent, Arn. How difficult can it be for someone new to the wrestling business to find his or her identity? Do you have any advice for young talent who's trying to, you know, establish themselves as a character?
Sometimes there are things that you do that you don't even realize will benefit you into getting over as a wrestler. Like, you know, what are your habits? What are your things that you like to do? Can you play piano? Do you play an instrument? Can you shoot a bow and arrow really, really good? You know, what things are your hobbies that you never even thought might translate into something wrestling fans might like to see? I'd have them research theirself, research all the things that they find fun or they like to do, you know, and sometimes there's a million fans out there that like that too. You know, hey, do you ride horses? What do you do in your free time? Do you like dogs? Do you like cats? It can be anything about you that you can bring to the table that'll humanize you.
Right.
It will make you relatable.
PN News like to rap, apparently, you know?
Bad, bad, bad. Yo, baby, yo, baby, yo.
There you go.
Yeah, we'll leave CN News on the chopping block.
CN News. Oh, man. Brad Stanton's up next. He asked, did you ever hang out at DDP's nightclubs back in the day?
Never. No.
No. He wasn't going anywhere near there, Brad.
No.
Oh, man. He said, while Paige tried to learn some of the basics and fundamentals by working with you, there were a couple other new additions to the roster that I want to mention here, Arn. First, one of the most powerful men in pro wrestling is here in WCW. Paul Levesque made his WCW debut in the spring of 94 as Terra Rising. And yes, that really was the name of his character. Trained by Killer Kowalski, Levesque would go on to have a Hall of Fame career, capture the world title 14 times, become the head of NXT, and now he's the creative mind for the entire company. But here in 94, Arn, he was just starting out and getting his time on television. Man, you want to talk about feeling old, but he's working mostly with Terry Taylor. Do you remember meeting Triple H when he was a rookie?
Liked him immediately.
Huh.
He was so respectful. He had his ducks in a row as far as the history of the business, and he was learned. You could talk to him about any subject matter. But he, you know, and Rick, same thing. Liked him immediately. Let's take that kid with us. And you could tell that he had something, even back then, and you know, and the different character terrorizing, you knew that he had something. And the one thing I figured out pretty quickly, because it didn't take him long to figure out, that's a young guy you can build some stuff around. I mean, nobody knew he was going to turn into be Triple H and be the power player of the business. But they, you know, we all knew that he had something and he could become part of the crew. But I figured out pretty quick, all he talked about was WWF. That's where he was born. He was raised. He worked for Killer Kowalski. He lived in the WWF area up there. He would go to shows there. He wanted to go there. And they offered him something. I want to say they offered him like 90 grand and 125 guaranteed for a kid just getting started out and without running a lot of shows at that time. I think that's what they offered him. And I went, Paul, you got to take that, man. How can you not take that? That's pretty good money, you know, to work a couple days a week. He said, yeah, but Arn, I want to go to the WWF. And he was headstrong about that from day one. it was very, very, very clear that's who he wanted to work for.
But you know, one of the things I've always appreciated about him, Arn, is that he also was a fan of Crockett and NWA wrestling. And to me, that has helped give him a different lens for the respect. The fact that he has the Dome Globe in his office, the championship NWA belt, that's the original. It's mounted in his office. And I love the fact that he has an appreciation for all of you that helped, you know, what you did in the Crockett years. I just really, to me, I'm like, okay, he's grounded. And just not WWF. He's got that Crockett history, too.
Watch his matches. Watch his matches. They would have fit perfectly from 86 to 89. And that's the style that he still, if he was going to go have a match tomorrow, it would be a 1986-87 match. You know, you don't see him standing on the top rope doing a moonsault out to the floor.
That's a good point.
He's a wrestler.
He's doing, and we've seen him do a few spine busters in his day, too.
Damn good ones. And you know what's another thing that at the time it kind of floored me? He came up to me after I was working there, after they hired me as an agent, and he said, I'd like to start using the spine buster. Do you mind? Really?
Yeah.
I said, of course not. I'm retired. You're
like, here's the blessing, buddy. Go for it.
He was the first guy that ever asked me
respectfully
to use my move. And he did a damn good one. He still got a good one, I'm sure, if he needed it.
Yeah. Wow. So cool. So listen, unlike Terrorizing, though, the next arrival of the company, Bunkhouse Buck, portrayed by Jimmy Golden.
Awesome.
He's a veteran of the wrestling business, one of the most over wrestlers of the Continental Territory, Arn. Bunk was brought in by Colonel Robert Parker to dispose of Dustin Rhodes. That was the goal. And you had worked with Golden. You just said awesome when the Continental Territory was red hot. But I believe that was when he was a babyface, is it not?
Yes, Continental. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, it was him and Robert and Ron and Bob were the core of the baby faces for Continental. They were all the top, and they were there for, God, they were there for probably 8 or 9 or maybe even 10 years. That's unheard of. That's weekly towns.
Now, eight or nine or 10 years. Wow.
Well, now how they worked that magic is like, if it was Jimmy and say it was Jimmy and Robert would work for 6 months or 8 months, and then they would take some time off. Bob and Ron had taken time off while they were working. Then they would switch roles. They would bring those guys aboard. They would work for 6 or 8 months, and then they would switch it back and turn one of them heel. I mean, they were smart. Nobody worked year-round because weekly towns, 52 times a year, seeing somebody, you know, you might run out of shit to do.
Did you like Golden better as a heel or babyface?
I love that Bunkhouse Bunk character because it was like he would get in the ring and he would do this thing with him. Remember, he would scrunch his face up.
Yeah.
His teeth disappeared. I couldn't figure out where his teeth went. His whole face when he became Bunkhouse Bunk just disappeared. He became somebody else.
Right. A total different look.
Had a great punch. You know, his work was all solid. Bumped good. He just a really good performer.
And here we go. Bunkhouse Buck. They're going to form the Stud Stable. And in a few weeks, we're going to discuss how you joined the group. What did you think? Did you like this? The whole building of the reformation here of the Stud Stable? You having fun with this one or what?
I didn't know that if it would be very successful or fail or any of the above or in between. I know that was a great group of guys, but it was like a cowboy gimmick. And it would be, they actually wanted me to, which I tried, you know, wear a leather vest and a couple of things, you know.
It's very Southern
style. A very Southern group clique. Yep. But it was pivoting off of the angle that we'll talk about on another show. So the launch was okay. I think the launch was good and the angle was good. It was just, I don't know how that I fit in that group. I was in everyone's eyes, I was a horseman.
And we'll talk about that more too. But so this is a fun period. Fun guys coming in. Let's finally talk about, as we start to wrap up the show, the tour of Germany. And that takes place in March of 94. Arn, you're not on this tour that took place after Super Brawl. It's been 30 years. Do you have any idea why you missed this overseas trip? If you don't, it's totally fine.
Yeah, my track record really wasn't too good about overseas trips.
Understood.
That should be self-explanatory.
Where's Crystal? It's funny. We got some comments. Oh, didn't talk about all the things from the last overseas tour. Read between the lines. Didn't want to talk about it. Okay, that's Orange Choice. So yes. There you go.
We'll say, and I won't ever talk about it.
There you go. Well, listen, this tour took place from March 8th to March 20th. It features Flair, Vader, Rude, Regal, Austin, Ricky Steamboat, Harlem Heat, and most memorably, Cactus Jack. Fans were treated to a number of great matches as the wrestlers rotated in and out against each other. But Arn, the match that everybody still hears about to this day, it's March 16th. It's in Munich. It's the tour of Germany. In the semi-main event of the evening, Vader defeats Cactus Jack in the quarterfinals of the European tournament. And as reported by our buddy Richard Land of the history of WWE, following the entrances, Cactus takes the mic and cuts a promo on Vader in German. This guy never ceases to amaze me what he can do. Cactus Jack Mick Foley.
I don't remember that.
Yeah. Well,
he knows German.
I guess. This is also during the match that he loses part of his ear when he went for the hangman spot between the second and third ropes. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, he came back in the locker room holding his ear in his hand.
That's sickening. He spoke extensively about it that evening, and there are two things that always stand out. First, the spot itself. Arn Cactus was not the first to hang himself between the ropes, but he lost the ear because the ropes were too tight. He says, and it just did not allow for that spot to be pulled off safely. Do you ever remember the first time you saw that hangman spot in general?
Didn't see it very often. It was an occasional, maybe seen it once or twice my whole career, because it was hard to do that. You had to take a bump over the top.
Yeah.
And pull that second rope up over your head. It was not easy.
It doesn't sound like a spot that you would have signed up for.
No, I don't. Wait, I'm going to really hang myself? I mean, like, really?
Arn's not going to the top rope. You.
Guys,
he's not doing a hangman spot.
We're entertainers. I'm not going to really hang myself.
Yeah. No.
Sorry, Jack. More power to you, but.
Yeah.
No, well, thanks.
He lived with the consequences the rest of his life. Cactus has stated that WCW did not take advantage of the spot to build a program between him and Vader. Instead, they left him tagging with Max Payne and later Kevin Sullivan, my buddy, against the Nasty Boys. By the way, I want to have you on a Kevin Sullivan show. He always brings you up, and I think it would be fun, the three of us talking.
Okay. I love Shorty.
Yeah, we'll have fun. But from Cactus's point of view, this was the perfect reason in his mind to restart a program with him and Vader. Instead, they continued a story with the Nasties that have been going since January. And according to Cactus, not capitalizing on the spot was one of the reasons he left the company and went to Japan and ECW. Arn, what do you think about this? Do you think this would have been a good opportunity to run the feud back with him and Vader?
Well, we got to remember when WCW, you weren't allowed to do a lot of stuff. And standing out there holding your ear in your hand is a little too graphic for what we were allowed to do.
Yeah.
Remember, juice was a big issue. Bleeding was a big issue in that period, because of the virus and all that.
So they weren't going to use that as a pivot moment.
No. They're not going to exploit something really, really gory. That's why they didn't do the angle.
Nick Lenz wants to know if you were shocked to hear, see what I did there, that Mick Foley lost his ear in Germany.
I saw it.
Yeah.
He came back in his ear.
Yeah, but I don't think you were on this tour, Arn.
He had it when he brought it back home with him.
He brought it. That's where you go. Yeah.
I went in the locker room and he said, he pulled it out and had it in a little cup. much respect to Mick Foley for what he's done for the business, you know, and the lengths he's went to beat himself half to death.
This is the same guy that now dresses up as Santa Claus every year and takes care of little kids and sends Santa letters. And
he's always done that. He did that from the very beginning.
And he does death matches and loses his ear. I mean, this guy, you talk about the faces of Foley. I've never seen anybody that's so dramatically different from one side of the arena to the other.
He's a lot tougher than I am.
He's incredible. We're going to close the show down with some questions from your fans. Drew Landry wants to know if you were ever nervous about overseas trips.
You think? They were hard, man. They were hard. There was a lot of travel. There were a lot of 20-hour travel days.
I couldn't imagine.
When you include the first, you know, getting to the airport 2 hours before your first flight, and you know, because you got to check in, you know, internationally, and then you have a 8 or 9 hour leg, and you got another layover, and then you got another leg, and then you got to clear customs on the other side. You probably got to go to the building early if you're not staying in the town. So you got to eat up 3 or 4 hours that way, 5 hours. Then you have like a 5 or 6 hour bus trip afterwards. Do the math.
Sounds terrible.
It'll kill you. Sometimes that was the first day.
And then you're not even talking about what it does to your sleep and jet lag. And your eating schedule, because we like to have a schedule with eating, you know.
Well, it's hard to eat healthy like that when you're in airports or on a bus, you know, have enough to eat.
Guys, I'd be a miserable bastard, man.
Well, you did what we did. You drank yourself to sleep.
There you go. Alcohol and everything else. No wonder these guys turned to what they did.
Yeah, of course. I mean, once you've slept all you can sleep on these flights and in airports, and now you're sitting on a bus looking around and there's alcohol available.
Yeah. Give me a glass, baby.
Yeah, man. Get some of those beers, buddy.
Yeah. Steve Levin was paying close attention to you and Regal during his time and has an awesome question. Arn, can you please explain why pro wrestlers used to wipe their feet on the apron before entering the ring? And hardly anyone does that anymore. You're great. I listen to every podcast you do. And I forgot to mention, I pre-ordered your book on Amazon. Really looking forward to it. Steve, thanks so much, man. That's awesome.
Thank you, Steve.
Yeah.
Real simple. The guys that understood what they were doing, it was respect. It was because when you walked to the ring, there was all kind of dirty stuff on the floor, on the walkway, on the aisle. When you got up on the apron, still outside the ring, you would wipe your feet off to make sure if you had any dirt or anything on your feet, you were respecting the people that were going to wrestle after you. That's the reason. And it was a respect thing. Some of the veterans knew about it. You know, it's like walking in a locker room that you don't know anybody, and you go around and you shake everybody's hand and you introduce yourself. It's just one of those unwritten rules. Clean your feet before you get in the ring.
Nowadays, the aisles look a little different. They're like, you know, nice sparkly tarp type things they walk down of when they're coming down a stage. And it's a little different than back in the day when you would walk down on the concrete.
Yeah, you got to remember, we walked down, there was just concrete floor a lot of nights.
Yeah. Adam Krasnoff wants you to tell us about Nick Bockwinkel. What did you think of Nick Bockwinkel in the role of the on-air authority figure during his time? Did you enjoy working with Nick?
Nick came across great, I thought, you know, that he had that accent, not sure what it was. It was Minnesota, obviously, but, you know, I thought he did a good job being that guy. You kind of believe that he was the boss for a minute. But, you know, I never wrestled Nick. Nick was already through wrestling, you know, before I got involved, you know, anywhere that he would have been. But I thought Nick did a good job.
Yeah, he definitely carried himself with, you know, he just had that swagger.
Dressed to the nines.
Yeah, yeah. He had the swagger, and he was he had the style and the sound of a leader. So he played that role well. Bobby, KF5GTX, were you told that new wrestlers were coming in during this time period? Did they alert you guys? If so, what were you told about Terrorizing, and how did that perception change while he was there?
That wouldn't have been an announcement. He was just an underneath guy. That wouldn't even, I mean, there was no meeting or anything. Guys would just show up.
Come in and out. Okay.
They would just show up. And okay, well, I talked to so-and-so, and he said, be at TV. That's it.
Closing us down this week, Mr. Brian Haremza, once he says, at this time, you were more in a babyface role. How strange is it for you to be a babyface at this time? I know it's something you never really enjoyed.
I hated it because I had nothing to offer. I had no skills. You know, I had to just accept the fact that I couldn't drop kick and I couldn't do any of this fancy stuff. I wasn't one of those guys that when you got me hurt, that the audience was concerned for my well-being. They kind of thought, well, he's going to, you know, bite this guy's nose or hit him in the thumb him in the eye or anything like that. They figured I was going to heal my way out of there before it got too bad. So it wasn't like a Ricky Morton where when he got hurt, you were worried for his welfare.
You were more of a guy that people wanted to see get punched in the face. Is that safe to say, Arn?
Yeah. And punch somebody back in the face.
And now it's totally opposite. You're one of the most beloved wrestlers of all time. Isn't that something?
It's crazy.
It's completely the opposite of who your character was. It's completely 360. I love it.
Yeah. You know, I'm just glad they care one way or the other.
Yeah. Well, buddy, that's going to wrap us up for this week's episode. Not too bad for no clips for our first time. We made it through.
Well, you, my friend, are creative enough. You'll make this fun, and you can talk us through something. It'll feel like we had a picture playing right in front of us.
Well, I don't know about that. Listen, again, it's the support team. I've said it before, of the guys like Andrew and Marcus and the others, but it's a team effort. And listen, guys, we hope you were entertained and that you enjoyed some of this talk. We talked a lot about Hogan and his influence. This is a big deal for WCW. We're going through Arn's career. We talked a lot about who he was teaming with. We got some interesting things to come with you joining Colonel Robert Parker's group, as well as Mick Foley losing his ear. And I'm really excited to get into more of 1994. And we're going to do that next week, because next week, here's a little plug of what's going to happen. April, Flair and Steamboat, they renew their 20-year rivalry. Hogan situation is getting more serious. Spring Stampede takes place at the Rosemont in Chicago, Illinois, and it's going to feature the Boss versus Vader, Dustin versus your buddy, Scrunched Up Face, Bunkhouse Buck, the Nasty Boys versus Cactus Jack and Max Payne in a street fight. Foley's already lost one ear. What's he going to lose in that match? Rude versus Sting, and of course, Steamboat versus Flair for the world title. Sounds like a hell of a week we got next week, buddy.
94.
It was all going down in 94.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot to talk about next week.
Yep. And this is 2024. So hard to imagine. We're talking 30 years ago, Arn. And it's a lot of fun. Guys, listen, I haven't talked about it in a little while, but if you're not a member or part of the family, join us at adfreeshows.com. $9 a month. All your favorite podcasts. This one as well, early and ad free. And at the $29 level, you'll get every piece of bonus content. I'm talking the Taskmaster, Kevin Sullivan. Every week I sit down with Kevin, and we talk about Arn Anderson, and he says all kinds of fun stuff about Arn. I'm kidding. We have a blast, but we're going to have Arn on this sometime this year, and we'll have a good time. But you get the Monday mailbags and all kinds of great shows on there. You get Cassio, who's with Nick Patrick. Cassio Kid and Nick Patrick do a Monday mailbag show. I do one with Kyoto every other Monday, and then Cassio sits down with Nick Patrick, and you get the WCW ref, and he answers questions. That's pretty cool. So we're doing a lot of fun stuff over there. You get Zooms and other events. So check it out, adfreeshows.com. And as we mention every week, if your business targets 25 to 54-year-old men, no better place than to advertise with us right here on the Arn Show. And it's because it works. We've had some great partners with us. I think of Spider Grip and so many others that have asked to be a part of our show. You can do that simply by going to advertisewitharn.com and find out more how you can advertise right here on the Arn Show. And Arn and I would love to put over your product or service. So check it out. Advertise with Arn. Listen, next week, I said, we're coming back, April 1994. Arn, thank you so much for doing this with me this week.
God bless everybody.
On behalf of the Hall of Famer, Arn Anderson, this is Paul Bromwell, and we'll see you right back here next week on Arn.